Tax Committee to order. Thank you, members, and all of you in the audience for coming in today. This is going to be what we think is our last hearing. Next week, we're going to mark up an omnibus bill and send it up to the floor of the Senate. So we've got quite a bit of work to do here, so we want to keep testimony brief if we can. Make your best argument. And we're going to try to take authors. We're going to probably be out of order some here. We're going to take authors that are in the room. So Senator Tomasoni here. Senator Langseth, number two. Member Senator Langseth has Senate File 3336, a local sales tax for the city of Detroit Lakes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, this is for the city of Detroit Lakes, a 0.5% sales tax on food and beverage for some development area that Highway 10 was realigned through Detroit Lakes, leave some blank spots in there they want to redevelop. And I'll let the mayor explain what all it's going to be.
Chairman Bach, good morning, and members of the committee. Thank you for it. Senator Skoy, hi. Thanks for allowing me to be here today. My name is Matt Brink. I'm the mayor of Detroit Lakes. And I do have a handout that I can give you that explains our request in quite a bit more detail, but just in a nutshell, we'd like to get a 0.5-cent food, beverage, and entertainment tax in Detroit Lakes, and we've got four major projects that we'd like to earmark those funds for. One, as Senator Langseth mentioned, is the redevelopment of the business district that was vacated when Highway 10 was realigned in Detroit Lakes. In addition to that, we have a problem in our lake with an aquatic invasive species called flowering rush, and we'd like to dedicate some of these funds to doing what we can to eradicate and control that problem. We'd also like to use some of these funds for bike trails and other related recreational facilities to broaden our tourism and recreational facilities, and also to construct parking facilities in conjunction with our downtown redevelopment program. And with that, I would open it up for any questions. As I mentioned, I do have a handout that explains this in quite a bit more detail that I can leave with you today. And
Mr. Mayor, one question on who is going to pay the tax. I see the entertainment tax limited to theaters, concerts, and sporting events. Is it the city's intent to have the tax imposed on high school sporting type events?
No.
Or what's the intent?
We have a community center in Detroit Lakes, Senator, and events that are held there would be subject to this tax, but not high school events and things like that.
So
it would be exempt.
Would it be acceptable to the city if we said sporting events held at the community center, or is there a broader, just to trying to, if we're not trying to cast the net to events that are happening at the high school, or I think we need to be kind of clear about what the intent is. Are there other places in town where taxable type sporting events are going to happen? Or?
I think more of the focus, what we're looking for, is the food and beverage end of it. So the entertainment part, I don't think, is a significant part of this request. And if you wanted to limit it to entertainment venues other than high school events, that would be fine, or even limit it even further if you felt that was appropriate.
Is the entertainment, I mean, how much money do you anticipate raising off the entertainment portion?
I don't have an answer.
Was it worth the heartburn? I guess
I don't think it is.
That's my question.
No, I don't think it is.
Why not? Senator Langseth, anything further?
No. You know, this flowering rush problem on Detroit Lake. Detroit Lake is a Cadillac lake. I mean, it's got very, very expensive houses all around it and everything. And then this flowering rush came in there, and I've been out on the lake and so on, and it really is harming the lake a lot. And it costs quite a bit of money to try to eradicate it, and so that's what that one's all about, and it's very much needed in order to restore that lake to what it was.
Mr. Mayor, does it still meet the city's needs if we took the entertainment venues out?
I believe it would.
Senator Skoy.
Oh, Mr. Chair, well, if you're taking the entertainment venues out, then my question doesn't matter. But you do have that lakeside dance hall arena. That would have been subject to this also, wouldn't have it?
Yeah, we have a pavilion that's located right down on the lake. I'm sure you've been there a number of times. And That gets rented out pretty much every weekend in the summer for weddings, receptions. There are some dances that are held there. The JCs use it for our water carnival. I just don't think the entertainment portion of this is going to be significant enough to, you know, to worry about.
Well, Mr. Chair, why don't we plan on it that we would take it out? Why don't you go back and check, and if it's an issue, get a hold of Senator Langseth.
I'll let Senator Langseth know. We'll look at the numbers a little bit, and I can maybe get more specific on what the entertainment would include.
Mr. Mayor, we'd appreciate that. If we could know by Monday morning, if the entertainment portion is going to raise money that really the city needs to accomplish what you'd like to do, then we want to work with you and get the language that you need. But if we also don't want to get mail from parents of school kids who had to pay a local sales tax to get into the kids' ball game. So
I understand. I'll get it to Senator Langstaff before Monday.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
Chair lays over Senate File 3336 for inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. Senator Tomasoni here. Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I haven't seen you for a while. Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate File 3338 is a simple authorization of a tax by the city of Biwabik to impose on the Giants Ridge recreation area. And the idea behind it is to allow Biwabik to impose a 1% general sales and use tax, a lodging tax of not more than 5%, an admissions recreation tax of not more than 5%, and a food and beverage tax of not more than 1%. And the idea behind it is to create a fund at the IRRRB so that we can do some amenities and some fix-up at the ridge itself and try to attract more people. The City Council of Biwabik would have to approve it, and at least seven members of the Iron Range Resource and Rehabilitation Board would also have to approve it. And so there's a few steps to go through, but I can that's the simple explanation of the bill, Mr. Chairman. Brian Heedy from the IRRRB is here also. He can add a little bit to that, I think, and I also have a couple of people who might want to testify in favor of the bill.
Deputy Commissioner Heedy, comments upon the bill?
Mr. Chairman, briefly, the agency would use these dollars, as the Senator said, to supplement agency dollars to improve the amenities there that serve all the stakeholders at the site.
And Mr. Heedy, a lot of unmet need? Aging assets there?
Mr. Chairman. As we look to the future, there's everything from looking at major renovations such as a new chalet to new lifts, those kinds of things, and they're all very expensive improvements.
And Mr. Chairman, this will create a dedicated account, and the account will be specific to Giants Ridge for improving the amenities. There's no doubt that the amenities have a positive effect on attracting the people to the area. Improving them, making them better, making the lifts faster, that type of thing, has a pretty good effect in attracting more people. I guess I don't have any scientific evidence to say that it's true or any professional evidence to say so, but the maintenance is an important part of any recreation area, and keeping it up to date and trying to attract new and more people is a very important thing. And I think when you fix up an area like Giants Ridge, not only do the people who use the area feel the people from the area care about the tourism and care about the people that use the facilities, but I think the word of mouth gets out from the people that use the area, and it spreads, and it has a snowballing effect, getting more people to come there that maybe didn't come before. There's also an attempt to develop much of the land around the area to housing and condos, and one of the ways of selling that area is those areas is by actually fixing up the Giants Ridge Recreation Area itself. So this is what the attempt is for.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, one thing that I might add, it may be common knowledge, perhaps not, but our agency owns and operates these amenities, and they have a very large economic impact. Last study that we have, 2005 figures, shows that the combined economic impact of the two golf courses and ski area is in excess of $34 million. That was in 2005. It was projected that by this time that would grow to $48 million. Now, because of some of the market conditions, perhaps it hasn't got quite that impact. But I guess the point is it's got a significant economic impact to Bowabic and the surrounding areas, surrounding communities on the East Range. And as Senator Tomasoni said, those amenities have attracted private sector development at the site, and we are working with a number of developers that are in the process of developing land there that, of course, depend on quality amenities. In fact, there are a couple of gentlemen here from one of the development teams that we're working with from the Residence Club, Mr. Licken and Mr. Dobrin, should you care to talk to them about what they think the impact of these of improved amenities might be, that might be financed by these funds.
Mr. Heady, any idea kind of revenue potentially raises?
Mr. Chairman, it would depend, of course, then on which taxes ultimately were authorized. But I would say from $100,000 to $500,000 a year, depending on which taxes are and at what rate were authorized.
Senator Tomasoni, we may have a constitutional issue with line 2.22.
I'm worried about that.
Just want you to be aware of that, the idea of not taxing somebody because they happen to live in some geographic area and treating somebody else differently. But we'll check some constitutional experts. Committee members, the line is 2.22. The city may also include an exemption from the tax for individuals who are residents of the area. That might be problematic. Just want to make everybody aware of that. Anything else to add?
I don't know. Do you want to listen to these two gentlemen that came down to chat? Or
did they drive down from up north?
No, sir.
Did they come down for some other purpose?
No.
Then we should hear from them. Right. Senator Tomasoni, while they're coming up, you ever thought about a food and beverage tax or something in the city of Chisholm to maybe help with some of the operating costs at the Iron World Discovery Center?
No, Mr. Chairman, I have not ever thought of that. But I maybe could.
Well, it might be a discussion worth having maybe with the businesses in Chisholm, because they certainly benefit from the Discovery Center operation.
My name is Bill Licken. I'm here along with my business partner, Stan Dobrin. We are developing a project at Giants Ridge called the Residence Club at Giants Ridge, where we will be building, we've bought land there, and we are developing residential properties at Giants Ridge. From our perspective, for our project to be successful, we depend on the on Giants Ridge, the resort, to be successful. And they have some beautiful amenities there in the way of the golf courses and the ski hill. The reality is that the ski lodge and facilities are in need of repair or replacement. There is a 20-year plan on doing improvements at Giants Ridge, and certainly our investment up there is contingent upon and in line with thinking that Giants Ridge is going to grow and to be really a world-class facility and an attraction for Northeast Minnesota. And so we support this this legislation to add tax dollars and to hopefully continue to improve the facilities there. In our opinion, looking at the facilities, if they're not replaced at some point in the near future, there's going to be considerable cost in maintaining and updating, and hopefully with these dollars, some significant improvements will be made over the next few years. So we as developers up there are certainly fully supportive of this tax legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Lakin. Commissioner Heedy, do you know, or maybe you could find out by Monday, does the agency need any special authority in order to sell bonds and use this account to pay the debt service, or do you think that's within the current authority? It just seems like some of the larger, rather than on a pay-as-you-go basis, the agency might want to bond for some of this larger projects and then use the proceeds of this enterprise account to pay the bonds.
Mr. Chairman, if I'm not mistaken, I think under the use of proceeds, subdivision 2, lines 1.19 through 1.21, it does contemplate that these proceeds could be used for.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Thank you. Our Senate Council did a very good job, I guess. Anything else to add?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of from left field, but when the gentleman was talking about developing condominiums, there will be a bill introduced today having to do with developers and transfer fees put on.
I'm familiar with that, yes.
Don't do that.
Yeah, we are not.
I'm having a hard time, but
we are not. Incidentally, we are not developing condominiums, but our project is a fractional ownership, single family project. But I'm familiar with the transfer fee concept, and we have not explored that area at all.
Okay. Yep, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid, are you implying that putting a covenant on a deed requiring a transfer fee might
every time the property is sold
might be prohibited by law at the end of this
soon
session?
Mr. Chairman, I hope. And I just, when they were talking about developers, and I thought of it, and I thought,
Senator Limmer.
Yeah, thanks.
As much as I enjoy creative capitalism, I agree with Senator Scheid on the proposal. But
may I ask, is that a current topic being discussed?
It will be.
In Minnesota?
It's going to be discussed like in the next day or two.
Interesting.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
The one question I did have, the city of Bewabic is asking for a taxing authority now. Is this like a local option sales tax, and would it be subject to the approval of the citizens in a referendum vote?
Senator Limmer, council tells me no. It is required to be approval of the city and approval of the Iron Range Resources Board. But we certainly could require a referendum if the committee felt they wanted one.
Usually, Mr. Chair, we do that when it comes to local option sales tax. I get a little nervous when we start raising taxes without, at least in this regard, without it. But
well, Senator Limmer, the law hasn't historically had a referendum for lodging or recreation or entertainment, but on local option, that's true.
I see.
Okay. Senator Thomas, Mr. Heedy?
Mr. Chairman, if I might point out that this tax is for, it's confined to the boundaries of something that's defined in statute called the Giants Ridge Recreation Area. So it does not include the city of Bewabic proper. It does, however, include the several square miles immediately around the resort.
So the intent is not to impose the sales tax on the main street in Bewabic?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Is that okay?
That is different, Mr. Chair.
So we're trying to capture some revenue of the people that visit Giants Ridge and then reinvest that in the facility?
Exactly, Mr. Chairman.
Sort of like a Vikings use tax, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, would this be this model, would this be something that might be able to be applied to the Mega Mall in Bloomington?
I think it's probably pretty similar. We gave the city of Bloomington the authority to impose a local option sales tax at the mall, a definition of the mall property. So I guess this probably parallels that.
I'm assuming that did not have a referendum on that either,
because
it's specific to a a specific, let's say, address.
Correct.
Or a region.
Okay.
Very much parallels that.
All right.
Anything else, members?
My name is Stan Dobrin, and I'm Bill's partner at the Residence Club of Giants Ridge. The only point I would like to add in support of this is that much planning has been going on for a number of years now for the redevelopment or development of a village concept at the base of Giants Ridge, right square in the center. And the new ski chalet that is being worked on is really the centerpiece of that entire development. And in my opinion, at least, and I think in Bill's and many others, without that chalet being put into place, the rest of the village plan is virtually impossible to do because everything will revolve around it. This type of tax is taxing authority is extremely common in recreation areas. The city of Vail, city of Aspen, all do these things to support the recreational facilities within their various areas. So I think this is, in our opinion, it's something that is really necessary to maintain the vitality of the whole Giants Ridge area.
Thank you. Senator Tomassoni, we're going to look into the residency exemption. So I can't on the constitutional issue, but so if this ends up in the tax bill, there may be an amendment to it relative to that because of constitutional issues, but just want to make you aware of that. Chair Lee Zolver, Senate File 3338 for inclusion in the committee's bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Senator Lynch. Senator Lynch, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm here with Senate File 3347. This bill has to do with the City of Rochester, and I would describe this as clarifying language and largely technical in nature. And what we're seeking to do here, in part, many of you know that we are hopeful that the Mayo Civic Center expansion and renovation, which was passed by this body and by the legislature and ultimately fell victim to the veto in the governor's office, but we are trying to best position the city so that they are in the best position possible as they move forward to seek their bonding dollars on this. Mr. Chair, I have with me today the Mayor of Rochester, Ardell Brady, and the Rochester's Assistant City Administrator, Gary Newman, and I'd like to ask Mr. Newman to describe the details of the bill.
Chairman Bach, members of the committee, it's a technical bill, basically, that resulted from looking at the language with our bond attorney and our financial consultant. Subdivision 2A allows the bonds to be issued if the project moves forward as revenue bonds with a general obligation pledge. That's simply to secure a lower interest rate. You get a considerably lower interest rate if you have a GO pledge on the bonds. The revenues will be sufficient to retire this. The second part of it is, again, for comfort for bondholders. In Subdivision 3 allows a possible refunding bond issue for the remaining principal if it looks like the revenues decline for a period of time. So it's really both of these provisions would provide comfort to the bondholders and help with the selling of the bonds, and that's really all they're doing.
Mr. Newman, no new tax increase in this bill?
This is the taxes, the food and beverage tax and the lodging tax were passed last year. There's no change in that. There's no change in the overall cost of or scope of the project. It is simply to deal with the issuing of the bonds for the project.
Mr. Mayor? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. We're here, I'm here also to just express the support that the city has to make this change, to be correct, and also to support our senator in presenting this bill.
Senator Sinjum, is this okay?
Mr. Chair, this is one of the best bills you'll ever see. And along those lines, I'd move adoption for possible inclusion.
Senator Sinjum, if it's such a good bill, how come it only has Rochester authors? Senator, all the work that Senator Langseth put into helping the city of Rochester. And Senator Langseth, do you think they'd have given you an opportunity to be an author on the bill?
Okay. Well, you'd think so, but I always forgive once.
Mr. Chair, there's always there's still time. We'll auction the last three places off.
Senator Sinjum's motion to lay Senate File 3347 over for inclusion in the committee's bill. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Lynch, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Newman,
thank you
for coming down. Senator Perry. Senator Perry, you see how easy that is?
I do.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, Senator Perry, welcome to the Tax Committee. I think this is probably your first visit here since being elected. So first let me say congratulations your election to be a member of the State Senate, and thanks for being in front of us with a bill today.
You bet. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. We come before you today with an extension to the current option sales tax, and I do have an A1 amendment. Would that be appropriate to do that at this time, Mr. Chair?
Senator Scoy moves the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment just cleans up language in the bill. I could go through that if you would like. What it does is just remove, there was one concern about removing a section on holding a special election, but after talking with the mayor and the city manager, they can put this all together if approved before the general election this year. With that, it just cleans up language.
Counsel, why don't you tell us if Senator Perry's description of the amendment was accurate?
Mr. Chair, his description was accurate. The first change deletes one of the uses because it's my understanding that that use is already contained in another one in the bill. And that's what the first three lines are. And as Senator Perry mentioned, Mr. Chair, it deletes the special election because the intent is to hold the election at the next general election. And then with the change on line one, it required a change to the overall dollar amount. And that's the amendment, Mr. Chair.
On the A1 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I brought along with me our Mayor Tom Kuntz and our Fire Chief Mike Johnson. I wanted them to speak just a little bit. I'm going to ask the Mayor to speak first a little bit about the current sales tax that we have now that is due to expire and before the 2011 legislative session and the importance of extending this sales tax. Mayor Kuntz.
Mr. Bach, Senators and members of the committee, I am Mayor Tom Kuntz of the great city of Owatonna, and it's my privilege and honor to speak about the existing sales tax and what our future projects are. The existing sales tax has been very, very beneficial to increasing a couple new roads coming into our community, a couple traffic signals that have helped control the traffic flow. It has done protection of waterproofing on our West Hills complex and our library complex, and it's taken and put together a third floor finished off a third floor in our fire hall, which is our county resource center when there's a disaster that takes place, when we need somebody to come in from the Red Cross or the disaster committee. We've now got an area where we have communications, an area for them to meet. So that current sales tax that we have has been very beneficial, and we have had no negative comments coming back from the public, to me anyway. Our new sales tax would extension of the sales tax would help the West Hills complex. The West Hills complex holds our city offices, it holds our art center, and it's also a meeting area for A lot of people from around the county hold weddings in that. We have meetings from around the county in our old orphanage. It was a state school once upon a time, turned into an orphanage, and the city bought it in the mid-70s. So it's been very, very beneficial, and it's been used widely by our county for different projects and different things. This project would help repair the roof that's needed to be done and also do some snow issues on it so we can melt the snow without having to have roof problems. It also would do some repair on our library roof. The second one is we've been privileged to have a citizen donate some land and a couple of ponds that are heavily used for fishing. We got some panfish in it. The DNR have been beneficial in doing some stocking of it. And we need to develop a parking lot and a pavilion and stuff for that area. We also have then would provide a canoe access to our river. Right now, the people that come in and want to use the river and canoe and kayak down the river have really no place to park and unload their canoes. This would be able to benefit to that. It's also got a great benefit to the neighbors that are around there and would eventually connect to the Wildflower and the Stagecoach regional trails. The third one is that all the water that flows through Owatonna comes through the Strait River, and the water that comes from the east side of town through Maple Creek comes in, and every time we get a real heavy rain, Maple Creek gets overflowed and then causes some problems within our city limit boundaries before the water gets down to the Strait River. This amendment would allow us to do a study with the county, the DNR, to figure out a way to store that water before it comes into the city limits so it doesn't come in so fast. The third one would be looking at an 800 megahertz radio problem. We have to have our 800 megahertz radio in place by 2012, and I'll let Mike talk to that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to talk to you about the interoperability system.
Name?
Mike Johnson, Fire Chief, City
Fire
of
Chief? Okay, thank you.
We're in the process of implementing the interoperability radio system, which is going statewide in our community. We're requesting to use sales tax funding or extend that local sales tax option for the purchase of the equipment in the city of Owatonna so we can use that for interoperability. We really don't have a choice with this purchase of equipment. There's an FCC mandate that we have to replace our current VHF equipment, which is wideband, to a narrowband, or we can go to the interoperability, which makes sense because there's a state backbone for that system. The reason why we're looking at the sales tax option to do this is because it's a regional project. An example with our fire department, we generate funds not only from the city of Owatonna, but also surrounding townships where we provide fire protection. So this is a good way for us to generate some revenue to go through and pay for the expenditures for this project.
Senator Perry, what would former Senator Day think about the bill?
Well,
see him around the halls here, and we certainly don't want to do something and have him thumping us over the head here. Many
right.
of us
well,
spend years serving with Senator Day, so.
Right. I did talk to him about this, and he said, "Go for it, push it, get in front of Senator Bach, and he'll treat you right." And so
he told you that Chair is just a really good guy, then, did he?
He was telling me how easy you'll be on me in my very first appearance.
Senator Langseth, I'm just wondering, this flood mitigation work that the city's looking at doing, is would it be appropriate for the city to consider an opportunity to receive some bonding money for this kind of work? Or?
Well, Mr. Chair, we can't bond for a study. This is a study. So it would have to be cash. And they can do it. But
it says early phase mitigation work.
But I don't know. Yeah, that might change it somewhat. But we aren't able to fund studies with bonding. It has
right.
to be cash from a state level. They can probably do it at the
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I also serve as the Emergency Management Director for Steele County. This is part of our overall mitigation plan. Every county has to have an approved FEMA mitigation plan. We're in the process of doing the work for our next five-year phase for that mitigation plan. The reason why we need this funding is to include that into the mitigation plan. We have to have a study on what the possible solutions would be to eliminate some of the flooding and some of the damages that occur in the city. The area that we're looking at is actually outside the city, but we're looking for buffer wetland areas to actually slow the water down or retention or detention to mitigate that problem with flooding throughout the city.
So is there, Mr. Johnson, is there any construction going to be paid for with this, or is it all just actually a study?
This would not be any construction of the ponds, retention, detention ponds. This would actually go through and use an engineering firm to give us the ideas or recommendations on what the best way would be to slow that water down when it goes through that water basin system. We would need to have this study to actually include that into our mitigation plan.
Mr. Chair, it's very possible that it sounds like the RIM program may be a possible source of funding, too. I'm not sure, but if it's just restoring wetlands and this kind of thing, that Senator, might be a source as well.
We would look at all of those options, but before we get to that point to determine if we use other wetland programs, we actually have to have an engineer look at what the best recommendations would be to address that problem, and that's what the study would be.
Well, Mr. Johnson, Senator Langseth makes a good point. It might be RIM eligible. It might be worth putting an application into LCCCMR. I think there's, rather than the city carrying the whole burden themselves, there might be some other opportunities worth exploring at least.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the purpose for the that five-year mitigation study, which is a FEMA plan, is actually in that process. If you're approved in that plan, that makes you eligible for federal assistance for mitigation funding for those projects for mitigation.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Senator Perry. Looks to me like over a third of this is the public safety radio system, and committee members, you know, we've had the Armor Group in front of us earlier this session looking for the sales tax exemption. My concern here is if, you know, as controversial as these local option sales taxes can become, if we are to allow this, you know, every community that's going to be impacted by that Armor Group is going to be in here wanting the same sales tax to help them pay for it. So I do have a little issue with that portion here.
Senator Perry, we have over 50 counties that are undergoing the 800 megahertz work. We tell one city or county that they can use local option sales tax. How do we tell the others they have to use property taxes?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, I think the mere sake that the sales tax is in existence now and we're asking for an extension, obviously, my excitement about this is by being approved today, we take it back to the citizens and let them decide how important. And that's really where I see our government to be, is letting the local citizens, who obviously are going to have to pay for this, decide which projects are most important in this issue. How you deal with the other counties that are looking for help will be a creative issue that I'm sure the tax committee will have to take a look at, but I think this flows naturally for what we have in existence already.
Or we'll figure out we won't have to deal with it.
Right.
Anything else, members?
Chair, I would move.
Sir, thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 3349 as amended for inclusion in the committee's bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
What do we have next? Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. While my testifiers are making their way to the table, I said I would let you know I'd be very interested in that local sales tax option bill as well if the committee decides to move forward with that. We have all sorts of armor issues in our area as well.
Why would we be surprised, Senator Spray?
We're not at all.
Well, Mr. Chair and committee members, I have a really great bill for veterans before you this morning.
Senate File 3117, you'd like to go first with?
Yes, okay. Please.
Senator Ropes, go ahead.
And I do have an A1 delete all amendments, since this is my first opportunity to present the bill.
Is this the first committee that the bill's been in front of?
Yes, sir.
Senator Skoy moves the A1. That's a delete all. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Erickson-Ropes, the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3117 provides that a surviving spouse of a 70% disabled veteran who's receiving the homestead market value exclusion would continue to receive that exclusion indefinitely until such a time as the spouse sells, transfers, or otherwise disposes of the property or remarries. This bill passed through, I believe, last year with a one-year exclusion after the death of the disabled vet to allow the spouse some time to readjust. And from discussion with some of the disabled vets community, family members and veterans themselves and veterans groups, we just thought this was a good bill to extend indefinitely for the benefit of the surviving spouse. And I have two members at the table, Gina and Craig Fisher. And Mr. Fisher is in that 70% disability category, and they'd like to speak to the committee a little bit about what their situation is.
I'm Craig Fisher. I'm from Burnville. And I'm not in the 30% area. I'm 100%. In 2007, when the original bill was considered, I had asked for property tax exclusion of $5,000. And this to be continued until the widow died or the property was sold. A 100% evaluation for this situation would cost much less than 70, 80, 90. 70%, if not working, could apply for individual unemployability, which is, in essence, a 100% evaluation. If you're ready to 70 and still apply for that, that would be the logical thing to do. Believe me, the cities, municipalities, and counties would accept this. They don't want to pay the taxes for people that can work, and it's a win-win situation for all the veterans and the taxpayers. Thank you.
Mr. Fisher, thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gina Fisher. I'm from Burnsville, and I'm nervous again today. Sorry.
Don't be. You heard, if you were listening to the previous testimony, you heard somebody say that people outside the building think the chair's a really good guy. So you'll be fine. You'll do just fine. Don't be nervous.
Okay. I'm Craig's wife. We've been married for 27 years, and I wanted to give just a brief, the highlights of kind of our life together and how things have deteriorated over the years. Craig was severely wounded in Vietnam in 1967 when a 82-millimeter mortar landed in the foxhole with him. And it blew off his buttocks at the time, and as you can imagine, then it affected his lower back and hamstrings and all of that. He went on to get married and have two children, and unfortunately, as is often the case with severely disabled vets, my understanding is that the marriage did not last, and Craig and I got married then in 1983. And when we first got married, Craig, I knew he was severely wounded, but his disabilities didn't impact things, you know, too much. He has a lot of shrapnel, and from time to time, the shrapnel would it works its way out of the body, and sometimes it would get abscessed, and it would be very. It has to come out of the body to a certain point where the doctor then can see exactly where the shrapnel is, so it becomes very painful before they finally can get in there and dig it out. So we had a couple of those situations. Another thing that happened almost from the beginning was he had undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder. He himself was working as a supervisor for the Disabled American Veterans. And personally, I think part of it was hearing the stories of all the other, generally men, and sort of stuffing his own feelings. I think it started to come out in his night dreams. And I was working as a court reporter at the time, and I simply could not sleep with him because of the thrashing and the language. And I mean, he would just scream. Oh, it was difficult. Anyway. So we began to, at a young age, not be able to sleep together on any kind of regular basis. And the third thing that I've written down is he would need occasional help getting out of bed because of his lumbar spine being so severely impacted by the wounds. He literally, some days it took him, and this is not an exaggeration, 20 minutes to get out of bed by himself. He just couldn't find a way, and then finally I would have to help him out. So anyway, that was the early years, but I will say that things were, other than episodes from time to time, things were fairly normal. Well, then about 15 years later, in 1997, he developed a blood pressure that was off the charts, even with medication. And his post-traumatic stress disorder was also very bad, and he retired at that point. Once he retired, and I don't know if it has something to do with the retirement or not, but his disabilities really started to escalate at that time. The post-traumatic stress disorder was bad. The nightmares, I believe, were worse, but again, we weren't sleeping together. But I heard, I recall hearing louder, more vivid sort of conversations coming from his room. He started falling at this time. He had had a drop foot prior to that, but he started falling, and one particular horrifying incident was I couldn't find him one day, and I was looking for him, and he had fallen behind the garage and just could not get up. And another time I had gone to visit my sister who lives in West Virginia, and he reported to me he had fallen 5 times while I was gone. Just very difficult to hear. In addition to that, because of all the medication he is on for his depression and the heart condition that he's got and various things, he started developing acid reflux, which it sounds, oh, acid reflux, no big deal. Well, it really affects a person's life when, you're 35 years old and you have to eat at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Because he can't eat any later than that. And the other thing that, unfortunately, and this is a tough one to talk about, but it is the reality, he developed erectile dysfunction from those medications. And as a man in particular, that's it doesn't help that depression problem he's got too much. Also, at around that time, the time he retired or so, he started needing more help with, and it's not every day, even to today. Some days he can't put his shoes and socks on. It's not all the time, but that's, again, it's sort of, I don't know what the word is, demeaning it to have to ask for help to put your shoes and socks on. It just adds to the depression. And basically, his disabilities sort of started taking over at that time. My court reporting began to be in the back burner around that time as just the stress of dealing with the various issues. I started taking over his medical care in terms of making the appointments at the VA, managing his medications, because sometimes he would, I put the medications morning and evening, and occasionally he would take his night medication in the morning and then be in bed for the day. So I started really trying to manage that. Anyway, I stopped court reporting altogether because of the stress, and I started doing an occupation which pays about a third of that rate, called scoping, which is assisting court reporters in preparing their transcripts. And then what jumped to 2006, that's when things really, really started to get bad. He had a stroke. And as a result of the stroke, because of this acid reflux that I mentioned earlier, he has this acid reflux, and he, because of his, I think it's called, is it dysphagia? Mm-hmm. Dysphagia. He's, of course, hard to understand, but also he's got a swallowing problem. So he has had aspirating pneumonia 25 times, where I've either had to call 911 or I've had to rush him to the VA because he's got a high fever. Sweats. He sometimes falls out of bed, and it's impossible to hold any kind of a 9-to-5 job or even be at a deposition at 10 o'clock on a Monday morning when I've had so many of these episodes where he just needs my help. And I mean, it's desperate. It's a desperate situation. And I could go on and on with other examples as far as him, but maybe I will just finish up quickly by talking about just a couple of things, how it's impacted me. As you can imagine, obviously it's stressful, but one really stressful thing is Craig is 11 years older than me, and he's been always more of the forceful person in our marriage. And for me to now have to negotiate with this person who has been, he's got early stage dementia, from the stroke, and to have to negotiate with someone is very, very difficult when, I mean, you hear this probably from wives a lot, but I know I'm right, and it's just very difficult to try to, navigate that. Patience is also a problem for me sometimes. He just needed a new computer, and I literally, and again, no exaggeration, at least 25 times I've had to tell him where the button is to turn the darn thing on. It's just, there's way more I could say. I've got several notes here. I think you get the idea. And I would turn it, I guess I turn it back to the chairman if there's questions, or I don't know how this works exactly.
You're doing fine. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think what we understand from this testimony is that the family members are greatly impacted by the lives of disabled veterans. And we as a nation, a state, and community are extremely grateful to the family members as well as the veterans themselves. Because the veterans back in the day may have volunteered for service, but their families were drafted. And when they come back and they have disability issues, some of the family members act as caregivers at their own expense and deal with employability issues and employment issues for years. So as a result of that, I think many surviving spouses of disabled veterans certainly have earned the market value exclusion that we're talking about here. So I thank Mrs. Fisher and Mr. Fisher very much for coming in to testify. I want to thank them on behalf of the Senate and the state for your service to the country and your service to our servicemen. And actually, when you're looking at things in terms of the whole state and revenue, Mrs. Fisher's probably saved the state and the county a lot of money herself by providing in-home services to the veterans. So I think we have a huge debt to not only the veterans but their family members, and that is at the core of this bill. Mr. Chair and committee members, I want to also let you know that I've worked with other stakeholders who are in the room. Some of them are not going to come up to testify, but just to let you know, Michael, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, has no concerns with the bill. I've talked to the AMC representatives and took care of a couple of their concerns in the amendment. The County Assessors Association has recommended some of the changes that we incorporated into the A1 amendment. And then also Jerry Kaiser is here as well from the Joint Legislative Veterans Council, and he has a little bit of testimony to add as well. So do you want to just trade spots
sure.
with Mr. Kaiser?
Mr. Fisher, Mr. Mrs. Fisher, thank you for coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, this has been kind of an interesting issue because I was personally the author of the bill in 2008 that created the valuation exclusion. Representative Rukavina was the author in the House. We included it in the omnibus tax bill and put it into law, and for the first time in 2009, this valuation exemption was available. But I thought what was kind of interesting was listening to the governor take all the credit on the radio. And the governor had nothing to do, veterans, the governor had nothing to do with this provision, ended up in law. This provision came out of the legislature. And I know, the governor's been very supportive of veterans, like many of us in this room. And I think it would have been helpful and a little more sincere if the governor had given some recognition to the members of the tax committees in both the House and the Senate that really were responsible for putting this provision in law. And we felt pretty good about doing it. But who else would like to testify on the bill?
Good morning, members of the chairman and members of the council. My name is Jerry Kaiser. I'm the vice chairman of the United Veterans Legislative Council. We represent almost all of the major veteran organizations in the state of Minnesota. And with my fellow veterans here today, the American Legion, the Disabled American Veterans, the VFW, and any other ones, and we basically are the entire group of veteran organization that support this 100%. And we appreciate the House and the Senate and their getting this bill through. It really comes down to the point that these men and women who are the surviving spouses have really earned this, and it is a tremendous economic problem for them when they have to, after 2 years, have to have that tax come back on again. And usually in the situation with the World War II veterans, these elderly women and men who are the surviving spouse are just, it's an almost unbearable program again where they have to have this tax added on. And there's not that many Minnesota disabled veterans that are in the 70 to 100% range that this is applicable to. Most of us are, I'm a disabled Vietnam veteran myself, and I don't qualify for this because my percentages are not there. And we just wanted to say that we support this, and we support Senator Ropes' bill here, and we wholly endorse what you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Mr. Fisher?
Chairman, Craig Fisher, if I may. I worked for 26 years for the Disabled American Veterans as a National Service Officer Supervisor. I never had a day that I didn't feel like going to work. I told my director that I had to leave. It was a very emotional time for me. And I'd be working today if I could, but it's just not there.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Would anybody else? I think we have somebody from the assessors down that want to testify on the bill. So.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Steve Kuha. I'm the Cass County Assessor, also here representing our state association, Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, but also am wearing a second hat today. As a veteran myself, I want to thank Mr. Fisher for his service to the country. I also want to thank the author for taking care of some issues that we thought were of importance. And the amendment that's before you certainly does that, so we are here to speak in favor of this language the way it is proposed in the amendment. Thank you.
Mr. Kuya, I don't remember that there was going to be this many people eligible for it. I mean, when we did it, and maybe somebody from the department can help me, but I thought when we did this, I remember we thought there'd be a couple thousand households available. And now it looks like there's 13,000.
No, I don't think so, of at least 70%.
Somebody from the department here?
Say, Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Say, Mr. Chair, before Mr. Kua steps away, I just wanted to mention to the committee, I know this is a little bit in the middle of this discussion, but Mr. Kua is going to be retiring after 30 years, or April 30th, after 27 years as the Cass County Assessor, and he's spent 20 years as the legislative chair of the Legislative Committee. So I just wanted to recognize that Mr. Kua is... worked a long time, and I appreciated the information that we've gotten from him. So thank you for your service, Mr. Kua.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, thank you very much. That kind of caught me off guard there, but yes, it's been a long time. I've been wandering through these halls trying to figure out what's going on. And I'm not alone. There's a lot of us in the room here that have turned out to be comrades over the time and tried to be resources to you folks to come up with meaningful legislation that's good for policy of the state. So thank you.
Well, Mr. Kuya, we do really appreciate the work of your association. We realize that decisions we make around this table have to be carried out on the ground, and you're the people that have to do that. So your input in crafting that so that, you know, we accomplish the legislative intent once it gets deployed on the ground has been very helpful to us over the years. So thank you for your service and your help for many of us around this table over the years.
Thank you for the comments. Very kind.
Thank you. Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Eric Ouellette with the Department of Revenue. We just some of the staff from Revenue just huddled, and it's our recollection that our original revenue estimate was that there would be about 11,000 participants. About 7,000 of those would be in the 100% category. I remember we based that on some information we got from the Veterans Department. So some national data that we had to extrapolate to Minnesota.
So is the number that are currently taking the exemption 8,550? Or is it an aggregate number of 8,550 plus 5,800?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that. I think that's the aggregate, 8,500. Is that right? Yep.
That's so the total is 8,550?
Yep.
Yes, that's what I want.
Mr. Ouellette, thank you. Any other questions, members? Senator Erickson-Rose, my one concern is that somebody could receive an exemption at a very young age and essentially pay no property taxes the rest of a surviving spouse pay no property taxes the rest of their life. That's my one concern. I think we need to take a look at some kind of an age threshold on it. I'm not sure that exempting somebody from property taxes for potentially 50 or 60 years just seems like we need to do a little work in that area.
Mr. Chair, we have had that conversation about the broad spectrum of surviving spouses that this may affect. And I think that's originally why they had the 50-year age target in there, but that would cause some concerns from the county assessors about how to track that kind of age requirement. And, you know, most of the situations that we can think of are highly anecdotal. And for every time we think that there's going to be a young spouse who is early in her in her life and marries a young vet that winds up passing away and is on this market value exclusion, you know, we're going to have older women who spent their entire life and paid down the cost of their house off of disability checks and that sort of thing. And yet there could be a lot of young wives that spend a number of really intense years, as we heard from Ms. Fisher, dealing with a disabled vet coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan today. And the likelihood that those young women would continue to stay in exactly the same house their entire life, I think we have to understand that in the social context of today's really mobile population anyway. So at this point, we thought it would probably be make most sense just to leave it as the being a provision for all surviving spouses, with the exclusion carrying over until they sell, transfer the property, or remarry. Because the remarriage issue, frankly, Senator, might capture a lot of those young spouses.
We wouldn't want the provision to preempt them from becoming remarried either, though.
Well,
Senators, just go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson, well, I didn't catch all of the assessor's issues with the 50-year limitation. Could you?
Mr. Cuya?
Mr. Chair, if I can address that. Senator Skoy, you certainly understand sometimes the difficulty we encounter when we're trying to administer some of the laws. We have to ask for Social Security numbers. We have to ask for, are you married? Are you divorced? Are you separated? For a lot of, you know, homestead laws and whatnot. What would happen here is we would now have to start asking for birth dates, because we don't know if the individual, if the spouse is 50 or over 50 or less than 50. So we'd have to start to incorporate in our questioning and in our applications now age information, birth dates. I think that would be viewed as something that's maybe none of our business, and perhaps it is, but if you put an age limitation in here or some threshold, we're going to have to ask the questions to find out exactly where to draw the line and administer it. So we would prefer not to have to, you know, get into that realm of private data. But also from a veteran's point of view, and I think all the vets in the room would certainly agree, if we, you know, we've got a lot of troops going to Afghanistan and Iraq, younger folks, fellas and gals, and if they end up into one of these situations of a disability, but they aren't allowed to participate in this kind of a benefit program, it separates the older vets from the younger ones. It just seems like it's treating our veterans in an inequitable fashion. So from that viewpoint, we'd like to see the age issue not be part of this as well.
Mr. Chair and committee members, to that point, thank you for bringing that up. I've heard very clearly from the veterans organizations, and being a veteran myself, they say they want veterans treated equally, and never again will one group of veterans abandon another because of age issues or the conflict that they happen to be involved with. So I think they have a pretty unified view of, if a benefit's available for a veteran, it needs to be available for all vets. And the same thing with the surviving spouses.
Senator Erickson Ropes, what about the spouse of somebody that's currently in the military who dies in action? That spouse is going to pay property taxes under the current law. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just a lot of stuff.
That's correct. That could possibly be another bill, Senator, if that's what you're suggesting.
That's my point, Senator Erickson Ropes, is the bills never quit coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, this one particular bill just deals with disability issues.
Anything else, members? Would anybody else like to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chair, just a question.
Senator Sandra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author. I think I'm understanding this, but just to make sure, if a qualifying veteran and their spouse would move from their existing home, let's just say a regular home into a town home because it just works better. Everything's on one level. Do they continue to get that exemption?
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, I believe that's true. It's there. It's on their primary residence, Okay. Wherever they're getting their homestead, wherever their homestead is identified. If they bought a second house, you know, it doesn't cover that sort of thing. Okay. It's a primary homestead residence. But you could double-check with Ms. Zoft on that. I believe that's correct.
Senator Ropes, I don't know if it matters. It doesn't say primary homestead, but at least as I'm reading the bill. But you
Mr.
may have
Chair,
brought up just
Senator
another question.
Senator, if the couple themselves move residences, I believe the exclusion travels with them to their residence as long as it's a primary homestead. However, if after the death of the veteran, the spouse changes residences, they lose the exclusion.
Mr. Kuya, what happens, and this might be a better question for counsel, but what happens in the case of the disabled veteran can't stay in the home any longer, but the spouse stays there, and the disabled veteran ends up in an assisted living building or in a nursing home, how would the assessors ever determine that should the exemption, maybe if the question is maybe better for counsel, would the exemption stay with the spouse even if the disabled veteran was still alive but not living in the homestead? And how would the assessors ever know that?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. I would assume that the prevailing homestead rules that we use would still apply. For example, if a homestead had been established and one of the spouses is absent from the property due to a variety of reasons that are allowed under current law, the homestead would still continue, just as it would if there was no disability involved at all. So the homestead status would still be there, and the benefits in this particular program, I believe, would still apply.
Yeah, I think it would.
Counsel?
Mr. Chair, I would agree with Mr. Kuha. I think if you look at the language of the existing subdivision dealing with this treatment, says all or a portion of the market value of property owned by a veteran or by the veteran and the veteran's spouse qualifying for homestead classification. So if the veteran continues to own that property and perhaps with a spouse, I don't see anything in this law that would disqualify that. And I'm assuming years ago we had a continuation of homestead treatment for individuals who entered a nursing home that the homestead would continue, and I think that was kind of subsumed under the relative homestead. So I don't think there's anything in the law that would terminate that homestead treatment.
Yes, Mr. Kerr, that's the line of rationale thinking I was thinking of as well. So continue.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Chair lays over Senate File 3117 as amended. Thank you. Senator Ropes, you have another bill?
Members. Yes, thank you. If you give us a moment to step away from the table.
This is Lane's bill.
Is this how we had it in the bill last year?
I think so, yeah. It has the requirement that it has him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
We have a second bill this morning, and this one is actually a bill that's been before this committee in the past. We have passed this bill in previous years, and it's been part of a larger omnibus tax bill that was vetoed. So we're bringing back the same concept and the same language. This bill adds a subcategory to Class 4C resort classification, and I have some unique situations in my small community of Lanesboro back in southeastern Minnesota. And they're a very small community that has a very large tourism population. And in fact, they're the bed and breakfast capital of the state and have small inns as well as the bed and breakfast community. So we're running into some pretty challenging tax issues down in Lanesboro because their industry and income is so linked to tourism. They pretty much roll up the carpet and snuggle in for the winter, making it very difficult for the small inns to continue paying their high-level property taxes. So we have passed this bill again in the past, and we have it before you again this year. We have Eric Bungie, who is one of the inn owners from Lanesboro, to talk in a little bit more detail about the situation.
Thank you. Senator Ropes, Chairman Bach, members of the committee. I guess I would be willing to entertain any questions you may have. This has been before the committee before and passed into legislation and vetoed. With the assistance of Chairman Bach, we were able to narrow the 4C classification that would speak most directly to Lanesboro to communities of 2,500 or fewer, townships, and especially with the DNR State Trail, biking, hiking trail that would run through it. So it's been narrowed and restricted to those areas of our state that are already being supported by the Department of Natural Resources through their trails. And this is not a shifting of property tax. Currently, the inns in Lanesboro, we have six inns who are qualifying already under an existing 4C seasonal rec classification. But it was written, it seems, by the language for more of our northern friends resorts. And every year it seems that we inns in Lanesboro have to add something or take away something from our customers in order to continue to qualify. So this language to add a classification to 4C speaks directly to what's happening in and around Lanesboro. Other counties in southeastern Minnesota that have trails running through them are also exhibiting some of these signs of needing this language. And it's a clarification for our assessors so that we don't have to have quite so many hoops to jump through that seem designed more for our northern friends.
We need your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Eric Bungie, B-U-N-G-E.
Thank you.
Hello, Senator Bach and members of the committee. My name is Colleen Lehman, and I am a business owner in Lanesboro, as well as I do work at the Chamber of Commerce. Today I'm speaking on both behalves, but our executive director was not able to be here, so I asked her to just kind of share some of her thoughts on this once again. She has been here to testify, and the first thing that we want to really thank you for is that you, the author of the bill last year, and that it did actually get to the governor's office that, of course, got vetoed. But if we continue the way that the current law reads, we limit our guests because it requires us to have two-night stays in order to fall under the seasonal rec classification. And Lanesboro is definitely a six-month season. This causes a trickle-down effect. It's loss of revenues for the state. It's loss of revenues for our community and especially for our small businesses. We have already adjusted our business practices. So as Eric has alluded, we require two-night stays when people only want to come one night, which is not very convenient for them. We have letters of support both from our city and from the Lanesboro Chamber of Commerce. And we've also been working with, as you'll see on the front of the bill, that Senator Sparks has also from Maurer County been involved with this now as well, too, as they now have a state DNR trail running through a couple of communities over in that area as well. So.
Thank you, Ms. Lehman. Questions of the committee? I think, Carlson, we had this in last year's bill. Is this the same language we were carrying in last year's bill?
Mr. Chair, this was the language that the Senate had. We had added the provision as the bill was going through the process, requiring that there be the state trail in the city to narrow it down.
And you were helpful with that, Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Chair lays over Senate File 3339 for inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming up, right?
Yep.
Mr. Cuyater, do you want to say something on that bill? We're only giving you a chance because you're retiring, and next year you won't have a chance to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Kuha, Cass County Assessor, on behalf of MAAO. Yes, unfortunately, this one is of pretty important concern to us. What we end up doing here, and I understand the intent, and it's admirable, but with this language, the way it's drafted, it's going to create some huge inequities amongst neighboring properties. For example, I've got a bunch of them just in my own neighborhood where there might be a 24-unit motel on the same trail as a 14-unit motel. They're both commercial right now. They really, you know, I guess they could rent some bikes and then go under the recreational umbrella. But for the most part, they're hotels and motels that are catering to the travelers, or they're not a destination like a resort is, a destination place where people come and stay for days or a week. These are hotels and motels. They're commercial class rate. They're paying state general tax at a commercial level. With this language, we're going to be finding many situations where there is a competing hotel-motel in the immediate vicinity. They are going to get the tax break, a significant tax break, because they will qualify under this language, and it's going to be claimed as a competitive disadvantage. It's going to be claimed as inequities between properties that are truly competing in the same area for the same clientele. And we would rather see, if you want to give a tax break for this type of a property, maybe do it through the income tax arena somehow with a credit or some kind of a reduction. But when you get into this classification issue, many of you may recall, it's been a number of years now, but the resort language that is in play now for the 1C and the 4C resorts, was studied and studied and restudied, and there were all kinds of versions, and this is what came out with cooperation of the resort industries and everybody else. This really does throw a pretty significant wrinkle in that whole process, and the hotel-motel industry is going to be at odds with some of their people getting a nice tax break and others that are just across the street or down the road not getting it. So the 20-unit thing is a factor. The trail is a factor. The community is a factor. The population size. There's just a lot of things that we're concerned about here that we wanted to bring to your attention.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kua, but doesn't this 250 days that they're open put a limit on that, where a lot of these other facilities would be year-round?
Well, it depends, Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, that depends on the way you count those 250 days. It doesn't mean necessarily that they're open for business 250 days, but their unit is actually rented with for a fee and used for a fee for 250 days. We see in some larger resort operations where they can actually monitor their units, and when they get close to the 250 days, they're rarely full 100% anytime. So they can modify their units usage so that they will always stay under 250 days. That's the benefit that's given to them as a resort. So the hotel motels could do the same thing, but they aren't going to qualify under these income provisions. But now these income provisions aren't going to come into play for this situation because there's an alternative way to measure it outside of the income language that we have here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kua, well, what if we started narrowing on the 250 days and made them be continuous?
Can I speak?
Ms. Lehman?
In Lanesboro, we read the law, and the Fillmore County Assessor Office reads the law that we are closed 250 days of the year. We do not. I'm sorry. It's the other way around, that we are open for 250 days. We do not accumulate those by unit. That is, our entire building is not in operation for the rest of the year.
I think that would be our intent, Mr. Who is it? Does the law not work that way?
Mr. Chairman, it does, but it works in concert with the rest of the provisions here, too, that 40% of their annual gross receipts have to come within a 90 consecutive day period of time, or 20%, you know, the different provisions in here about rental of fish houses and boats and ski equipment and things like that, those provisions are part of what we measure just as well as the 250 days.
And that's precisely, Chairman Bach. Eric Bungie speaking again. There's already an inequity in the state, and we find that we do not have fish houses in Lanesboro. We don't have a lake in Lanesboro. And we are subject to the 250 days, cannot be in business more than 250 days. If one room is let, that is counted as a day. So Colleen is correct that our inns are completely closed for at least 115 days of the year. And 40% of our income comes from a 90-day period. So those provisions work very well for us. What doesn't work for inns along trails in communities or townships of 2,500 or fewer is the restriction of two night or more stays, especially when the market is trending more toward staycations, getting away for a night. And so the state is losing sales tax revenue from our friends from Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, Nebraska, North and South Dakota, who want to come to Lanesboro. Lanesboro and that region of our state is a Midwest destination. Believe it or not, it's a Midwest destination. And because we have to deny people the one-night stay, many of our inns are denying one-night stays, our state of Minnesota is losing sales tax revenue from our friends from neighboring states.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment regarding the two-day issue. That was debated a great deal at the legislative level several years ago, and the reason for the 2 days versus 1 day is clearly to separate the commercial hotel motels from the destination or the recreational lodging facilities.
And Chairman Bach, we tried to do that by the 20 or fewer rental units, clearly falling in the mom-and-pop, family-run lodging establishments. You get over 20 units, 24 units, you're starting to really be a commercial business, and we do not have any inns of 24 units or more, of 20 units or more in Lanesboro.
But how do we address the issue of the Motel 6 that's on the trail?
There are none.
Well, but there may be.
Well, if they have 20 or fewer rooms, then I think they could qualify as a family-run in communities of 2,500 or fewer people. I think it's we have no franchises.
Colleen here again. When we testified last year on this particular bill, there was a comment made by our executive director, and we had been talking with the assessor's office in Fillmore County, and they are fully aware of what is going on. And quite frankly, the gentleman commented, it would be a lot easier on all of us if we could get this worked in, because not only do we spend time, days, hours, counting all these rooms, doing all of this, but they also on their end have the same things to do and have to follow through and make sure that we aren't open for 115 days, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So
I don't think you'd find a Motel 6 who would subject themselves to only being open 250 days and 20 rooms or fewer.
Senator Skoy?
Well, Mr. Chair, and you know, when we, when we've had these discussions about the resort properties, a big part of the rationale behind that was the these facilities were closing and we were losing access to our lakes for folks with more modest means. And I'm real sympathetic to these facilities, but I think we're going to have to try to figure out a way to make this language work with Mr. Kua's concerns.
Anything else, members? Senator Sundrum.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe to anyone, what is the logic of the 2,500 population? I'm just thinking of Preston, for instance, and I don't know what they are. They may not be 2,500 yet.
1,400.
Okay, but if they were, or if they became 2,600, I guess they'd lose at least these kind of properties would lose that exemption. And well, maybe my real question is, Lanesboro may well need this tax base. I don't know if there's anybody from the city here or not, but and I know that you need this exclusion to maintain viability, and so that's important too. But you know, I'm just, where's the balance here? Lanesboro may need this, frankly, more than Preston does, at least as they think about their local tax bases.
Well, Eric Bungie, Chairman and committee members, as I stated earlier, this is not a tax shift. This 4C classification is already being granted to these inns. However, the inns every year are forced to adjust their business practices to meet the ever-changing language in the 4C resort classification. To wit, many of us who do not have fish houses are now selling bait or tackle in order that we can qualify and meet the requirements as our assessor states them to us. What we tried to do, based on the chairman's recommendations last year, was to narrow the language so that it met the criteria for very rural locations, small towns, along trails, the DNR is already investing lots of money in. Not a tax shift, as I stated, not a tax shift. What we're finding is that southeastern Minnesota is different than northern Minnesota. These inns are the resorts of our communities in southeastern Minnesota. I don't think the problem or the challenge will go away. I think it will continue to grow. And if we can seek clarity and get clarity in the law, it will help. And the state will eventually see more money from sales tax revenue.
Well, Mr. Bungie, the in defense of resorts and the reason that they're in current law is there is huge pressure for subdivision because the land is so valuable. And so we didn't want property taxes, escalating property taxes because of the value of the land, to drive additional subdivisions and fewer resorts available for the public to use. So really the issue of resorts on water is really much different than what we're talking about here.
Different, but there are some similarities, Chairman Bach. The property value in Lanesboro, as you can imagine, has escalated as well, and that is being transferred onto the commercial properties. So it's different, but there are some similarities. And so.
Thank you. Anything else, members? Well, I think we already laid the bill over, so that was a little ancillary discussion. Senator Fischbach? Senator Fischbach has Senate File 3343. Senator Fischbach, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senate File 3343 simply provides an extension for a year for those companies participating in Job Z that in 2009 did not make their employment number requirements. And so this provides them a year extension in order to make up those numbers, to get back up to the requirement or the required numbers in their business agreement, and so that they are not dropped from the program. And I have some folks here from the department and from one of the companies that would be affected that had a very short, brief period of time where they were unable to make the numbers in their business agreement. And this year extension would provide them with the ability to bring those numbers back up, which I believe they've already done, and continue on the Job Z program. So however you would want to proceed, if you want to have those folks come up and give some testimony.
So, Senator Fischbach, it doesn't really extend Job Z. It doesn't extend the period of time. It just gives them an exception from meeting the employment threshold for the 1 year that they didn't make it.
Yes.
But their expiration date would still be the same.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And it just gives them, you know, because they dropped for a brief time underneath those numbers, so it gives them a year to bring the employment numbers back up. So, no, it doesn't extend the time. It just gives them a little more time to meet that agreement that they made.
So, Senator Fischbach, if this we put this in and pass this into law, we'll be here with that bill next year to say, well, they need 2 years?
Well, in the case of the company that is in my district that I originally brought this to help with, that would not be the case because they are already back up to their numbers. So they just need to briefly. And if the chair would feel more comfortable with a little bit different language that would tighten that up or anything, we would just like to make sure that these folks that during the economic downturn had some issues making those numbers are able to continue on the Job Z program.
Senator Fischbach, thank you. The department?
Mr. Chair, Bob Isaacson with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. This is an important bill. We see approximately 40 companies right now that will probably be unable to make their 2009 Job Z job creation goals despite making them in 2008 and previous years. 2009 was a devastating economic downturn, which I don't think I need to spell out in any detail, but we're trying to ensure those companies that already met their goals have a year grace period to get back up to that level at which they were at prior to the economic recession.
And, Mr. Chair, we do have someone from one of those companies if you'd like to hear from them. I've got Mr. Lynch from Columbia Gear.
Columbia Gear.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for this opportunity to talk to you and address the committee. We've been in this program since 2004. Our commitment was to invest $5 million and generate 38 jobs per year. Over the last 5 years, we have generated 595 jobs, 350 over our commitment. Last year, in 2009, because of the economic conditions, we saw a significant drop in employment during that period of time. We are now back at that level, and in 2004, when we entered the contract, there was language in there that would allow for a drop in or to cover a drop in employment. We're asking that language be reinstated so that it would cover us because, to our knowledge, you know, we had no idea that we would ever fall out of compliance with this program based on the way that we have generated jobs.
Any questions, members? Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lynch, just because I'm curious, are you back at the 38, or are you growing beyond that up toward that higher number again?
We're growing beyond that. We peaked at 402. Our commitment was 268, and we peaked at 402, and we're back to over the 270 now. And you know, we think we'll go back into the 400 range in the next 2 years, but it's going to take a couple years to get to those levels.
Well, that's good news.
We thought it was great news. So,
and members, the commissioner previously had authority to do this, and as a result of the legislative auditor's report that was very critical of some of the deficiencies in Job Z, the legislature tightened the provisions and of some of the commissioner's authority up, and this was one of the things that was taken away in the revisions to Job Z. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, that's accurate. I think the one element I might add is this is just a one-year period versus the entire length of the program. It's just for 2009.
Okay.
Any other questions, members?
Mr. Chair, I would like to just mention, I know that a fiscal note came out on it, and I disagreed with the fiscal note because I thought if these folks were already included in any of these 40 to 50 companies were already included in the program, then why would there be a fiscal note? And I did, Commissioner Innes is here to just speak to the fiscal note briefly if that's all right.
Commissioner, you have anything you need to add? Can you find us $1.4 million to do this?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Innes with the Department of Revenue. And, you know, we did go back and forth on these revenue estimates. I think it's fair to say that these Job Z related revenue estimates are a little more difficult than the standard nuts and bolts revenue estimate because we're trying to predict behavior, how many businesses are going to go out of compliance and be eligible for this grace period. So there's a lot of speculation involved, whether it's going to be 40 companies, 50. Will all of them take advantage of this grace period, only a fraction of them? So this is based on the assumption that 40 of these companies will take advantage of this one-year grace period. That's how we arrived at the number. I have told Senator Fischbach that we'll work with her. If the revenue estimate becomes a real problem for the chair and the committee as far as making it work into this tax bill, we can hopefully find a way maybe to narrow the scope of the legislation. I think Columbia Gear makes a very good point that when they signed their subsidy agreement, the law did allow for this authority under the Department of Employment and Economic Development. So they went into the program with the grace period being part of the general law. I think they've been one of the really good actors, one of the, you know, as far as the Job Z, they've been diligent in their efforts to be in compliance. They've, you know, so they have been what we intended this program to serve. So we will work. We'll work with the tax chair and this committee. If this is really an issue, like $1.4 to $2.8 million, which I think it may very well be, we'll try to do what we can to narrow the scope for purposes of Columbia Gear.
Well, Commissioner, I can find $1.4 million to pay for this. What I don't know is if when I get to conference committee, the governor will agree with how I paid for it. So having said that, I think it would be helpful if you worked with Deed, and in the event that the revenue that this committee suggests, because I think we should do this, but we all need to recognize we also need to pay for it, because it's going to cost the state $1.4 million to do this in FY11, $5.6 million in the next biennium. So we just all need to recognize that it's something that makes sense that we probably should do, but it does cost us money to do that. So, Commissioner, if you could work with Deed in the event that the revenue we're able to identify is not satisfactory to the governor, doesn't meet his test of, seems like this should meet the test of being revenue neutral, but I guess we'll find that out maybe when we get to conference. But
Chairman, your point's well taken.
Anything else, members? Senator Fischbach, thank you for bringing this. And Mr. Lynch, you've been a good success story for Job Z in a program. We haven't had enough success stories. So thank you. I'm pleased that the program worked for you, and we're gonna try to accommodate you so that you can continue to grow. Senator Fischbach, thank you, and thanks for finding five authors. Just a suggestion. I know Senator Sparks is a big Job Z supporter. Well, Senator Langseth is a big Job Z supporter.
And, Mr. Chair, I thought maybe once I put it in that there would be folks, because I wanted to get it in immediately, and that there – so we'll see what we can do.
I see you have five authors, though, so there's not room
for – Oh, do I have
– There's not room for more.
Okay, I don't have the sheet with them on there. I'm sorry. I thought you were implying I didn't have authors.
Oh, you have five. Chair Lee's over Senate File 3343. Senator Fischbach, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming down. Is Senator Youngbauer here? Senator Youngbauer, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And it was kind of interesting sitting here for a while listening to all these things. I did want to clarify that Lanesboro does indeed have a lake, although it might be extremely small since it's more of a trout pond, but we love to go down there every year. And Senator Langseth knows they have the dam down there across the street from the city park, and we like to go, our family likes to go trout fishing down there. So they do have those kind of amenities for those that haven't been to Lanesboro yet. But today, members, I am here on Senate File 3337. It is for the city of Ramsey to create a tax increment financing district within their Ramsey Town Center to accomplish some of the things they need in terms of transportation issues surrounding the North Star commuter rail stop that's supposed to be there in the future. Mm-hmm. And to spur this development on, this is a necessary way to do it through this this TIF district. I also do have an amendment here. This went through the House Tax Committee, and I guess we'd like to put on the A1 amendment right away as well.
Senator Skoy moves the A1.
I just saw
that. Council, why don't you explain what the A1 does?
Mr. Chair, members, the A1 amendment, the first provision on lines 11 and 12, modify the description of the geographic area where this district will be created. And then the next provision on line 13 is the remainder of that elimination of the existing description of the geographic area. The second part is an additional exception to a rule that would apply to this district. And that is that the five-year rule in the current law that requires that activities be undertaken within 5 years of the creation of the district would not apply to this district.
On the A1 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. No, the motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Senator Youngbauer, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this is now currently in the form that was laid over in the House for inclusion in the House tax bill. Today I have Kurt Ulrich, the city administrator for the city of Ramsey, and Matt Look, a city council person for the city of Ramsey, and they will explain what the district does and what they're trying to accomplish and how it actually helps taxpayers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kurt Ulrich, city administrator with the city of Ramsey, and here today to talk to you a little bit about Senate File 3337, and you do have a packet that was distributed. Within that packet is some bullet points. I won't go through all of those, but we'll give a brief description. And included is a map, as well as a map of the development, which is currently occurring or projected within the Ramsey Town Center area. This project, the Ramsey Town Center area, started out as a transit-oriented development, continues to be a transit-oriented development around a projected North Star rail station, which would be an infill station on the North Star commuter line. The federal government and the regional rail authorities in the state have invested over $317 million in this line, and the Ramsey Station would be an infill station to that investment. The city recently, in June of 2009, purchased 140 acres surrounding the transit station from the development, which had gone through foreclosure and bankruptcy, and are currently the owners of 140 acres surrounding the station and control development within this area. The proposed tax increment district includes 386 acres, which is a broader area around the transit station. But the area included in the tax increment, we feel, is necessary to spur development of that town center area and invest in the public improvements that need to be made in infrastructure, both the rail station, transportation, structured parking, pedestrian overpasses, and the like, which will create a more dense development, add more jobs, create a higher density for this area, both of jobs and tax base that will allow this area to be successful. There are two existing housing tax increment districts in this area, which would be decertified as part of the larger tax increment district. So that is our intent, to decertify the two existing housing districts within this area. The project itself is estimated to generate $3.5 million in local taxes ultimately and create 3,900 jobs and 600 housing units within the development area, and leverage an additional investment of $365 million in private investment to this area. Another important concern is public safety. The public infrastructure improvements we're talking about will improve public safety. The interchange at Armstrong Boulevard allows safe crossing of the track and movement of our police and fire vehicles to serve areas of the city of Ramsey which are currently disconnected and need to have that access. We feel, but for the investment in the public improvements, which would be allowable by this bill, that this project would not move forward and will not be successful. So we encourage your support of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ulrich.
Mr. Chair, thank you, members of the community committee. I'm a city council member. Matt Look, sorry, city council member with the city of Ramsey, and also sit on the EDA, the Economic Development Authority, the HRA, the Housing Redevelopment Authority, and I'm the chair of the Finance Committee. But I wanted to comment today just specifically on the TIF balance within the city. We are cognizant of the fact of having too much TIF, and we are striving to maintain a balance on that. We've decertified other districts in addition to the districts that were mentioned here today. And currently, our city has been awarded a AA bond rating, which, as we're told, is the best rating that a city of our size can get. So we are aware of TIF and the effects of TIF, and we want to keep our eye definitely on that ball, but we would appreciate your support today.
Mr. Ndouble, what do you think of this?
Well, I think it's a brilliant bill, and I love it. I think I have a variation on a theme coming up. So if we don't pass this bill, I think my bill would go a long way.
A variation or an expansion on the theme.
City of Ramsey, so.
Senator Johnson.
Senator Rest, you know a lot about the TIF.
Hmm? I'm with Youngbaum.
It does seem like the development's not going to happen unless we get the transit station and the parking and things built, likely. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Youngbaum, does the entire Armstrong realignment, is that part of this TIF development? My question is actually, doesn't MnDOT have to kind of approve that interchange?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, actually, that is in the works right now in terms of that whole interchange and that realignment. We've been working with the county, with MnDOT. The key there is the money hasn't been there at MnDOT. It's a big safety issue for the city as well. So that's another real reason this has to come, because as folks know in Ramsey, you have the train tracks and you have Highway 10, And in any emergency, the police and fire on the north side of the tracks, it takes a minimum of 6 minutes typically to cross at that area. So, yes, we've been working with MnDOT, county, the city's been working with all that, and we have to get simultaneous approvals to do and realign that whole project.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
I'm still not clear if this is part of this TIF development, if Armstrong realignment is actually part of it, and you're expecting to get it completely finished by the end of the TIF district.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, and the committee, the answer is yes. We do intend that to be part of the project. It's one of the public infrastructure improvements that I referred to, which are intended to be paid in part through the revenue collected by the TIF district.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But the design is not approved yet.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, the design, we are, as Senator Jungbauer had mentioned, we are working with MnDOT. We have a We're going through the design process now. At the end of this month, there's a design charrette, a day-long process to go through that. So we're actively involved in redesigning the interchange. It is a county road, so the county is actively involved with MnDOT, and all parties haven't been engaged with that discussion. So that is an ongoing effort that we have now.
Any other questions, members? If not, Chair Lee is over Senate File 3337 for possible inclusion in the committee bill. As a member. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thanks for coming
down.
Senator Jungbauer, thank you. Members, we've got some people from out of town that, in the event we have to come back after session to finish the agenda, I'd like to get the people from that came a long distance. Give them an opportunity to testify this morning. So I have a couple bills of my own I think I'd like to get to.
The ones for Stu here. Senator Bach, are you starting with 3340 or 3341?
Let's start with small mom-and-pop resorts, Mr. Chairman.
Senate File 3340.
Mr. Chairman, we talked some about small mom-and-pop resorts a little bit earlier relative to the Lanesboro provision. We've got a situation that's, I wouldn't characterize it as similar, but on the same issue up on the north shore of Lake Superior, where one of my constituent resort owners purchased a second resort about 6 miles up the road, up Highway 61. And both resorts meet the criteria of the mom-and-pop resort provisions. They sell minnows and have the required two-night stays and meet all the provisions. If they were separate owners, they both would qualify for the mom-and-pop resort classification. They both have been mom-and-pop resorts, but now because they are under one ownership, they don't meet the qualification any longer. So we initially crafted the bill with a five-mile requirement that it needs to be, the two properties would need to be within 5 miles of each other, similar to what we have relative to agricultural land, which I believe agricultural land does not have to be contiguous either. I think it can be within four townships, I think, actually, to be considered one ag property. So this would allow a piece of non-contiguous, a non-contiguous resort to be considered one mom-and-pop resort. And there is an issue with the 5 miles, because I think it actually is close, somewhere between five and six. So we may have to take a look at what the mileage actually is. We're going to consider putting this in the bill. But I have my constituent here that would kind of like to give you a little better idea and might, by naming the resorts, you might even recognize where they are on Highway 61.
Thank you.
Ms. O'Phalen?
My name's Maureen O'Phalen, And my husband Michael and I own Cascade Lodge and Restaurant as well as Solbakken Resort. They're both located in Lutzen. Senator Bach did a great job of really explaining in a nutshell what our issue is. We bought Cascade Lodge first in 2004. We lived on that property in a house that was there. We bought Solbakken Resort in 2006. The reason we bought it was that Solbakken has cabins and motel units on the lake. So we felt it was a great addition to what we already had, which is Cascade Lodge, which overlooks Lake Superior. So for us, it was we have two separate corporations, but we run it pretty much as one business. Our employees are interchangeable to a certain extent. So the reason that I'm here today is that I see us as being one of the very few remaining family resorts on the North Shore of Lake Superior. They're being sold out to larger corporations, and we're getting lots of condos built, and increased taxes are more easily shared among condo owners than they are by one family, and that's my husband and I. And so I went before our county board initially. I've tried to go the routes that I thought I should go, but I am not a tax expert, and I frankly don't think some of our county assessors even, as hard as they try, understand all the complicated property tax rules that Minnesota has. So I came to Senator Bach in December saying, I need some help. And I realize in listening to testimony here today, I am like small, small potatoes because my tax increase at Solbakken this year went up 94.4%, but that amounted to about $3,700, okay? But for me, for my husband and I to absorb that, it's really impossible. We don't make that kind of money from lodging. As you may or may not be aware, the lodging on the North Shore is down. The taxes that they're collecting for lodging taxes are down anywhere, even this year, between 10 and 15%. So for me to absorb this cost, it's really, really difficult. And what I really feel is going to happen is families such as myself who left the Twin Cities to go up and do a different lifestyle and run a good business, we employ 25 people full-time, we're going to be shut out because we can't pay our property taxes. And I really don't think that was your intention, but I need some help. I understand that the County Assessors Association is here, and they may have some problems with this. I'm not against some modifications because, again, I don't know all the tax laws, but I'm asking for a break so that we can stay in business and, you know, pay what would be fair. And, by the way, we lived at Solbakken for 2 years after we bought it, but the facility was too small. We have a large family, so we ended up having to move back to Cascade. So it's not like I have a house separate from either one of my businesses. I live, work, and breathe on my resort property. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Fallon. Questions, members? Mr. Kua? Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, Senator I think the assessors have raised a legitimate issue with me, and I think it's one of it. What we don't want, certainly the intent of this, isn't to allow the owner of the resort to build a multi-million-dollar cabin across the lake that's not contiguous and somehow have it included as part of the resort. And I think the way we have the language, that might be permissible, but I just want to be very clear that is not the intent for to allow the resort owner to build a non-contiguous piece of property and then get the resort classification on their home there. So we may need to do a little work on the language to make sure that this really is intended to be for the business. There's two separate businesses here that are being really run as one by one family.
Well, Senator Bach, maybe we'll just could add language that they would live on one of the resorts or the other. And Mr. Kua, perhaps you would want to consider or think about making this the same distance as the four townships that AG has so it's consistent, and if you have a thought on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Kuha, Cass County Assessor, on behalf of Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Our primary concern is dealing with some of the drafting language. I'm not even sure that we're totally opposed to the scenario that Senator Bach introduced about the if you're going to allow the owner of the resort to occupy a non-contiguous property, I'm not sure that it makes a lot of difference to us whether it's another resort or another single-family residence. The issues are still the same. But the drafting of the language creates some concerns or questions that we just wanted to share with you. And what we're doing here is creating a pretty significant expansion of our homestead situation and classifications. We've all heard about the problems with the special ag homestead issues, and they keep coming up year after year after year. There's some scenarios that are similar. You know, we'd be going down a similar path if we introduce this type of language in the resort setting. Although it's even a little bit worse, or maybe I shouldn't say worse, just it's loose. At least in the special ag areas, there are some there's some language that kind of ties it together a little bit more, which is absent in this situation. For example, ownership interest has to be the same in the ag, special ag situations. In this case, there could be different ownerships. We could have an LLC or a partnership or a resort organization that's created a corporation, and a shareholder could be occupying a different property and be eligible for homestead there. Another concern is one other resort permissible, but how about a year or so later they buy a third resort? And does that link to now do we have three homesteaded resorts, but only one owner occupying one of those three? You know, where's the limitations here? Just concerned about the broadening of the homestead and the tracking, the linking of the different properties, especially if they're going to be under different ownerships, just creates, you know, a pretty much of a nightmare for us to try to track and keep track of. And I'm not sure if it's your intent to, as a legislative body, to really expand it in that fashion. So those are some comments that I'd just share.
Thank you, Mr. Kua. Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Mr. Kua, if you would. That what you're talking to, those different types of ownerships and those persons that might live in the house, that's current law, right? So do you have trouble with that now?
Mr. Kua.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the I'm not sure that in regards to the Family Farm Corporation or the Special Ag.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, no, I'm sorry. I'm talking about this, the resort language, the Class 1C. And I'm looking where there's a dwelling occupied as a homestead by a shareholder that owns a resort, a partner in a partnership that owns a resort, or a member of an LLC that owns, even if the title is held by the corp. That's current law. So I just wondered if you had trouble or concerns.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, we don't have any trouble administering that. The records are clear as to which shareholders are part of that corporation, and then they have to apply for homestead on the property that they're residing in. So, no, we don't have a problem with that.
And Mr. Kua, are there income? I remember from our previous discussion that there are some income conditions to get the small resort. What am I thinking of there? Am I missing something?
It's a different.
Would those things be cumulative or separate, or how would that work?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that there are any income requirements. We have a tiered system of the first certain amount of value is at one rate, and it goes to a second rate, and then through to a third tier. Those tiers, that would be cumulative. Under this provision, if two resorts still are under the max, they'd get the benefit of all of it as if it were one property.
Class. Excuse me.
Well, that's 20% of the revenue and all that. That's in the different class.
Right. Yes, Mr. Chair. In order to initially qualify as a class, that would all have to have been established ahead of time. The
the difference.
Well, Mr. Kua, how would you do this if you had three resorts? Would they all have to meet that 20% of the criteria, or would they do that individually?
Well, Mr. Chair, they would have to, first of all, be in operation less than 250 days. They'd have to make a declaration to the assessor of that fact. They would have to meet the criteria of income generated within the period of time, and those issues all would have to be met on a individually resort view, because the second resort that's going to be occupied by the owners of the first resort has to be, as I understand, a 1C resort already, which means it had to have met those qualifications under previous owner or situation.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I
do think there's an issue in that. I think the way the language is drafted, you could own a resort and then build or purchase another piece of property, and it doesn't actually have to be a second resort the way I think the language is drafted. I think that's where I think we might need to do a little bit of work. Council, is my interpretation of that right?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, I think there may be a little misunderstanding, or maybe the language wasn't as clear as it should have been, but the provision on line 36 of page 2, as a homestead resort, I think we could clarify that application, that would apply to the reference to property on line 35, and maybe modify that by saying begins to occupy another property as a homestead resort that is located within. The intention was always to require that both of them could separately qualify as Class 1Cs if they were occupied as a homestead. So I think if we would just move that phrase up the line there.
I think, members, we'll work on the language some, but the intent is both of the resort properties meet the criteria. And if they had an owner living on them, they both would be mom-and-pop resorts. But I don't think the language quite does that. So we'll work on the language some, I think, to get within the intent to allow one owner that's operating it as one resort to just be able to have, not have to be contiguous.
And Senator Bach, if we're going to, I understood we needed to look at the distance a little bit. And Mr. Kua, is there any reason that we should or should not make this the same as the ag conditions?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I didn't address that when you asked me the first time. I apologize. It seems as though, in this situation, there's a specific issue in property and at 5 or 6 miles. If you're going to do it, don't cut it that thin. I'd try to make it consistent with some other language that we do deal with on a regular basis. So if you're going to do that, certainly put a reasonable limitation. If the four township rule is something that works, it would make sense to follow that type of a pattern as well.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, members? Anybody else, Senator Bach? Chair lays Senate file 3340 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Ms. O'Fallon.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy, we've got this people from the city of Ely here, and I just wanted to get them out of the way in the event we end up, it appears like we're going to have to come back after session.
Senate file 3341, Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, this, the idea of a local sales tax for the city of Ely has been in front of this committee before. We've actually, I think, a couple different years had provisions very similar to this included in the Senate bill, even I think back to when Senator Pogemiller chaired the committee. City of Ely did have authorization to hold a referendum back in 1992, and it did not pass. And so they're here looking for a second opportunity to hold a referendum to invest in some of the community's aging infrastructure. So, Mr. Chairman, I have constituents from the city of Ely here and would like to give them the opportunity to talk about their thoughts relative to the Ely sales tax. And I just want to be clear, this is drafted as up to 1%. That's not typical for us. I think or except for maybe in the case of the large convention center projects, I think we've kind of had a standard of 0.5%. So if we're going to do something, I would want to make sure that it's what we did was consistent with the opportunity that we've offered to other communities. Just want to be clear about that.
Whoever wants to start, welcome to the Tax Committee and state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Bach. I'm Roger Scraba, Mayor of Ely, and Harold Langowski, our Operations Director, is sitting next to Senator Bach. I remember a lot of you being here 4 years ago. Again, our community is very dependent upon local government aid, and in light of what's happening, our ability to keep our infrastructure and buildings at a level that's acceptable is becoming challenged. So we're trying to play, be ahead of the curve before it gets to us. And our goal right now is our community center needs a lot of work. It is a true community center. The people of the town of Morris, the city of Ely, the town of Fall Lake, and a lot of tourists use the community center. It is our library is in there. We have about 80,000 visitors a year that come through the library, and of the 80,000, we estimate that 40,000 are city residents. So it is a true community building, and that's going to be one of our priorities if this sales tax is enabled. And we also have a lot of trails in our Ely area. The Mesabi Trail hooks up to us. It's a state trail, and our own city trail that makes a loop off of that gets a lot of use. So we're very cognitive of what types of uses we can use this for. We definitely will keep it towards where everybody benefits from it, not an alley or things like that. That's not our goal. Our goal is to find the projects that we know we need to fix, and our community center needs to be ADA. We have to bring it up to American Disability Act, and it's in sore need. Our operations director could talk more on it if you have questions on it. But I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Let's get the testimony.
Oh, sure. My name is Harold Langowski. I'm a civil engineer and the operations director for the city of Ely. I've worked with the city of Ely for the past 10 years, the past 2 years as a full-time employee. Prior to that, I was a consulting engineer. What we passed out is we've put together a 10-year capital improvements plan. I've been working with them, like I said, for 10 years. This is the next step. You can see there's a large amount of projects on that list, totaling approximately $26 million. What we're looking at is the projects that are highlighted are the projects we feel warrant this 1% sales tax at this time. Right now, we have approximately 2,900 utility customers representing 3,500 residents in Ely. Over the past 2 years, we've increased the utility rates 25%. We can't continue to go down this route of forcing the utility customers and the taxpayers to share the burden of all the capital improvements required to keep Ely as a destination. Mayor Scraba spoke of the community center, the parks, our Whiteside Park area. That's where the festivals are held in the summer. That brings a lot of people to town. We cannot continue to increase property taxes and utility rates to maintain those, to put them into compliance with ADA, to provide the utility services. We've got some major infrastructure issues in this area, so that is why we're in front of you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Langowski. Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to mention, and I'm sure you've already done your homework, so I don't want to presume that you haven't, but in the realm of energy efficiency and conservation improvements to city-owned buildings, there are some fairly innovative tools that we've developed as a legislature that are available to local municipalities in the last couple of years, plus some federal dollars that can be brought in to match those efforts. So the financing of those has become fairly inexpensive for local units. You can get 25% just free money from the feds and then finance the remainder of those projects through your energy savings. So if you haven't considered that, I helped draft a few of those pieces of legislation. I'm happy to provide more information for you. In Commerce, our Office of Energy Security has a lot of information about it.
We would welcome
Mayor
that.
Scrava.
Yes. Excuse me. Senator Dibble, we would welcome to do that, get that information. We also, right now, we're in the infant stages of working with a biomass for the city of Ely. We're trying to get a central heating district, and the city buildings would be part of it, right, and larger customers. That isn't even on this scope, right, but we are meeting quite often on that. And just to speak of the 0.5% or 1% of the sales tax, our estimates, if we have a 0.5% sales tax, it really brings us into a more of a sharing where we need to find the grant monies, and this would augment that. It wouldn't pay for the whole thing. And we are, that's the, our whole goal always is to share and pair with anyone or any program that's out there.
Anything else, members? Anyone else want to testify on Senate File 3341? Senator Bach?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to, in the interest of full disclosure, I do have a letter that I received yesterday from the Ely Area Development Association, which is really kind of a broad group of school, city, county, a lot of businesses in the Ely area. There's a very large group. I've actually been a member of that development association for a number of years. They did send a letter in support of it. Having said that, I did get calls from some chamber members. Some of the businesses on Sheridan Street, the main street going through Ely, have got some angst about this. And I do hope to, before we move forward, find some peace in the valley with the business community, whether it's about the uses or exactly what it is, I'm not sure. But, you know, the city of Ely has gone through this exercise once and it failed. I do think it is very important that they have some more support than they have today from the city's actual storefronts, from the businesses that we're actually going to expect to collect this tax. I've asked for that. We haven't, we don't quite have peace in the valley there yet. So I'm not sure, I'm not sure. What I don't want to get, and what I was very clear with the city about, is I don't want to get in right in the middle between the city's business community and the local governmental unit. So we do have, even though the Development Association supports it, which is a very broad group in the region, outside of the city, which certainly we want that because they're going to be paying a portion of the tax, that we still have some work to do on behalf of the actual local Chamber of Commerce.
And someone...
Hello, I'm Nancy Larson. I am the Executive Director of the Ely Area Development Association, and we represent job creation and business growth opportunities for our city of Ely and the surrounding area. We are funded by the Joint Powers Board of City of Winton, City of Ely, and Morris Township, so we represent a broader area. It is our support of our business community that we believe that the sales tax opportunity will make a direct impact on our business community. We are working with them. We serve as a resource to our business community in bringing the resources they need to stabilize their businesses at this time and to grow their business. Our economic engine is our main street. We're a tourist destination, an international destination. Of course, everybody in the state knows about Ely and the beauty and the opportunities for to recreate. And we don't have opportunities to do great large industrial development. That's the nature of Ely. Ely is the second oldest community on the Iron Range. It has old infrastructure, and our tax base with our business community isn't large enough to support additional taxes to support infrastructure improvements. Sales tax would help our businesses by taking the burden off of them in the long run, and the sales tax provides a much broader financial base from which to generate revenue. But in my professional background is as a planner, and what I view the sales tax for the city of Ely to be is a wonderful
planning tool. They've not been able to plan for infrastructure projects in the past because they've relied so much on local government aid. And we all know that's going away. It's diminishing and will be going away. So this offers them a much greater opportunity to do long-range planning and to make the city leaders accountable to the community in achieving the goals that they set out with the comprehensive plan that they're putting in place for the sales tax. So it holds their feet to the fire, and it really provides a planning piece that so many of our rural communities have not had the luxury to be empowered to move forward. And so that's, I think, the greatest benefit for the city of Ely is it gives them the power to chart the growth of their community through this planning piece. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Anything else, members? Senator Dibble?
Maybe think about how much money I've spent in Ely. When I go up and visit Burnside Lake, maybe you could just confine the sales tax to that main street. It's scary to think how much money I've spent.
Mr. Mayor.
Mr. Chair, it's only in the corporate limits of Ely, so
yeah.
you're more than welcome to come back. And
yeah. I'm sure I'll lose some more money up there this summer.
That's very good. We appreciate you coming up there, Senator. Mr. Chair, a couple comments. I have a letter from former mayor and current city councilor Frank Salerno, and he wished he could be here. He wanted to testify, but he had his wife's health, and he couldn't be here. But he is in support of this. We actually have unanimous support from the city council. One of the reasons that the letter that we received from the chamber was, we don't oppose it, we don't support it, we need more time. They wanted to poll their membership. And by the time I got the word when we passed this, and by the time I got the date for this hearing, I said, we need a letter now. And they weren't comfortable giving us a letter right now. They want their body to digest it. I'm confident that after explaining this to members of the executive board of the Chamber of Commerce, they are starting to understand the difference. I mean, we have a public building that everybody uses that needs to be fixed and repaired. And we can either levy or tax you more for it, or we can try to get it included in where the public, everybody helps. And that's our goal, to educate. And I think once the education process gets through, I'm confident that our community will be in support of it.
I'll go.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Scraba. Seeing nothing else, Senator Bach, Chair Olay, Senate File 3341 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you
for traveling so far this morning.
Thank you. No.
Senator Dibble. Senate File 3348.
Can we go over?
Do you want to know? Chris just came. We're going to do this one.
Okay, well, that's cool.
We'll probably get that number with a half.
Then I'll stick around.
I don't think so.
This is the mobile home park.
Yeah, it's going to take a little while.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present Senate File 3348. Mr. Chair, members, this would replace a section of the department bill that we had taken out when that larger bill was passed, and it relates to manufactured home parks that have been converted to co-ops. We've had a couple of those instances now, Mr. Chair, members, over the last couple of years. There's been some initiative on the part of the state housing finance agency, as well as some other non-governmental organizations to assist in those conversions so that when these properties come up for sale, the folks who actually live there have the kind of the first option to convert those manufactured home parks into a co-op or a home ownership sort of situation, and the benefits are great. We preserve an element of affordable housing, low-income housing in our communities that otherwise would have to be replaced by some means or fashion, but we don't have any good mechanisms to do that. And it creates a sort of investment and of course, the stability that home ownership implies, but the sort of investment and buy-in that all of that implies, better care of those facilities, better investment and a stronger stakehold in our community, et cetera. The problem that we had with kind of the original proposal was the folks weren't were taxed at a 1.25% rate, and you know, we wanted to make sure that we brought that down to regular, gave them regular homestead treatment, and allowed them to qualify for the credit. Through the process of some significant discussion and negotiation, including with the chair of the property tax subcommittee, we've come up with an alternative proposal that would provide for homestead treatment of these manufactured home parks that are now owner co-ops. However, we would exclude them from the homestead market value tax credit and the renter's credit, and we would allow them to qualify so they wouldn't be double dipping, and we would allow them to qualify for the low income rental classification, the 0.75, if they've achieved a home occupancy or home ownership rate of 50%, or actually we need to offer that amendment, if they achieve an occupancy ownership rate of above 50%. With that, we do have someone prepared to testify.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just, there's a question.
Why don't you come forward and identify yourself?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Justin Bell. I'm the Legal and Policy Director for All Parks Alliance for Change, or APAC. We represent manufactured home community residents throughout the state. I'm available if there's any questions on the policy of the bill.
The reason, Mr. Chair and members, that we're trying to accomplish this is the hit to the individual owners would be fairly significant under the previous proposal. These are folks that don't have a lot of available money, and a lot of it is tied up in the purchase and the takeover, and this would create those couple of co-ops, and we have another couple coming online. Their business model, their pro formas would not work out, and they wouldn't have those dollars available to continue to make those payments to take over ultimate ownership of the park. So we wanted to get that homestead status, the class 4D classification to them, but then not allow them to double dip and take a deduction or a credit from their income taxes.
Senator Dibble moves to A1. Senator Dibble, have you got a copy of the A1?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've seen
it. Would you like to explain it?
Am I moving the amendment?
You're on the
or
committee.
Senator Scoy. Oh, I thought Senator Scoy was going to offer the amendment. But I can offer it.
Senator Scoy, on the amendment?
Yes. And I think Mr. Nord probably wants to say a little bit about this. But the issue that we've been struggling with these parks is because the resident is not real property, it's personal property. And so we're trying to work through all that. And the reason that the A1 amendment is in front of us is we wanted to make sure that as these cooperatives are developed, that the tax benefit is accruing to, you know, it's going to accrue to the membership, and we want at least half of the residents to be members so that the benefit is distributed out uniformly. Otherwise, a relatively small number of people could be receiving the entire tax benefit. And I'll offer the A1 if whoever should offer it, but I think this is in addition to the bill, and I've talked to Senator Dibble and the department and the advocates, and I think everybody's kind of in agreement on what we're trying to do here now.
Mr. Nord, any comments?
Mr. Chair, just to echo Senator Scoy, the amendment deals with the concern that it was clear when we talked to the co-op people that a 1% class rate for these parks, it would not be sufficient to get them the tax relief that they expected, but that the 0.75% would do much better, and in fact it would. But that kind of assumption relied on the park being mostly occupied by shareholders, and so there was some concern raised in the discussion about what if a park doesn't have a large share of shareholders, then the 0.75% might be a little too generous to their expectations, and so this amendment goes a long way to alleviating those concerns, I think.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shedd.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, does that mean that either some of the homes aren't occupied at all or they're being rented or something? Is that the concern?
Mr. Chair, members, typically they'd be rented. The folks who are there very well could have been there when the park was taken over by a co-op model, but they're not yet in a position to buy in and become owner occupants. You know, in some cases, that just takes a little time for them to be able to join in and become owner occupants. They would then be renters from the co-op.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schein.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me, though, that if they're renting and they're not able to, they can't afford yet to buy in, why would we want them to pay higher property taxes or the higher tax? So it seems to me that the break ought to be there.
Yeah, we are bringing it down from where it was
from
for everyone to the
1%
from the 1.25 for value above $500,000.
Yeah. Mr. Nord, if somebody's renting one of these units, are they eligible for the renter's credit?
Mr. Chair, it's important to remember, I think I'll get to your question. It's important to remember that the owner of the property is the co-op. And so if there were some of the lots that were occupied by people who are not shareholders or if they were renters, they're not going to get individual property tax statements. And so the co-op gets the property tax statement in this situation. And that was one of the problems with trying to interpret the current law, was trying to figure out this balance of giving individual tax statements to the co-op, to all of the individual units, but then having those not really be true tax statements, having the co-op on the as essentially the direct taxpayer, but enabling the individuals to use those individual tax statements to qualify for credits and PTR. And so what this language does is it eliminates that more difficult process of treating them as if they were property owners. And so they're not going to be able to get individual tax statements to use to file for PTR. They're not going to get their individual homestead market value credits, and instead they're benefiting from the lower class rate on the park. And to the extent that there is a renter, I believe that renters in manufactured home parks generally, whether it's a co-op park or not a co-op park, are eligible for PTR. But I'm not completely certain on that point.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, generally speaking, if you rent a lot in a manufactured home park, you are eligible for a renter's credit. There's three distinct situations that could happen in a co-op model. You could have someone who owns their structure and owns part of the land as part of the co-op, someone who owns the structure and rents the land from the co-op, and someone who rents the structure and rents the land.
Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, one of the things that brought me along on this issue, because I had originally a fair amount of concern about this, is the point that what we're trying to accomplish is owners that are more likely to be caring about the property that they're living on, and they'll make improvements and make this better for everyone and better for the community as a whole. And so, that's why I've kind of gone along with this 0.75. And then the other issue that is here is, the department and the assessors were going to have an impossible task if every, lot was going to have to try to receive the individual benefit. So I think we've kind of worked through this. I think it works pretty well. I think the 50% number is okay. It's got to be more than half. It says at least 50%. I want more than 50%. So we haven't adopted the A1 yet?
No.
I have an oral amendment to the A1.
Senator Scoy, your oral amendment.
I would like to strike least and put more than.
Strike at least.
At least.
At least. Is at least the same? I want it to be 51. 50 plus 1% is what I want.
More than.
So, Council?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, then you would want to strike at least and insert more than.
Yes, that would be my motion.
Senator Scoy incorporates on line 1.2 delete at least and insert more than. It's incorporated into the A1.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, what do you do if it's 50%?
What do you do?
I have a suggestion.
You have to be more than or less than, but if you're 50%,
yeah.
You're
so
just...
So, Mr. Chair, what I would suggest is, I'm fine with this change, and a class going to line 1.4, and a class rate of 1% if...
50% or less.
50% or less. And strike if less than.
Yeah.
So insert or less after percent.
Well, and Mr. Chair and members, the reason this is important is because these are cooperatives and they're going to operate on votes, and you want to make sure that the majority of these are going to be, you know, voters. So it's important to make sure that's more than 50%.
But if it's just 50.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's got to be more.
Council, oral amendment sounds like what?
Mr. Chair, the whole amendment would read now, if more than 50% of the lots in the park are occupied by shareholders in the cooperative, corporation, or association, and a class rate of 1%, if 51% or less of the lots are so occupied.
50%.
50%, yes.
Sorry. So everybody understand the amendment as orally? Senator Mwadi, get it?
We get it.
We get it,
Mr. Chair.
This I get.
On the A1 amendment as orally amended. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Dibble, anything further?
Unless committee members have questions, I have nothing further.
I know. Bill number. Chair lays over Senate File 3348 as amended. The Senate's under call.
Mr. Chairman.
We've got three bills left, and they're probably all going to take a little while. So we'll come back a half hour after session adjourns. Committee's in recess.
Julie, I have to.